You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a small cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled, What is Anthroposophy? This is Lecture 3, entitled The Spiritual Perspective, given in Dornach on July 22, 1923. As earthly beings, we initially know three alternating states of consciousness. There is the waking state. This lasts from the moment we wake up to the moment we fall asleep. Then there is its opposite, the sleeping state. In this, the soul to some extent dips into spiritual darkness and has no experience of its environment. Between the two is the dream state. Of the dream state, we know at least the following. We know how experiences from the waking state play into it, and how, on the other hand, certain extraordinarily meaningful and interesting inner forces can transform the relationships established in the waking state. We know, for instance, that long-forgotten events appear as if they were immediately present, how something that went almost unnoticed by consciousness, something to which we paid no particular attention when awake, can come to the fore in our dreams, and so forth. Things that are normally completely unrelated are brought together into the dream. It is also characteristic of the dream state that the content of the dream, everything that we perceive in the dream, has a strong imaginal quality. Even when words sound in dreams, it is the image quality of the words, their tonality and modulation, that enters the dream. The sounds, the words, are all transformed into images that the soul can hear. Dreams thus present many aspects that can touch the human soul in its deepest place. But we shall gain no insight into actual spiritual existence unless we can come to a valid idea of the relationship between these three states of consciousness, waking, sleeping, and dreaming. Today, with the help of spiritual science, I shall try to characterize these three states. I shall begin with waking day consciousness. We can easily see that we are able to lead our daily waking lives only in so far as, on awakening, we begin to use our bodies, our bodily organs, and also our thinking, which is connected to bodies. We are not consciously aware of the fact that upon waking, the capital I and astral body submerge into the physical and etheric bodies. Nevertheless, we can still experience, in a rapid but clearly perceivable way, how we recover the power over our limbs, the power over our organs, and the power to unfold our inner thinking. All this can teach us how the waking state is connected to the physical body. And if, from the point of view of spiritual science, we consider the etheric, or formative force body, we must also say that the waking day life is as strongly connected with the etheric as it is with the physical body. To conduct our waking lives, we must submerge ourselves in these two, physical and etheric, and make use of their organization. Without the illumination provided by spiritual science, it is quite possible to have all kinds of illusions about waking life. Little need be said here about the life of the senses. What could be clearer than that we use our sense organs in our waking lives, and that these senses mediate for us the revelation or manifestation of the outer physical world around us. We need only observe the senses a little to establish that what we call waking experience, the manifestation of the sensible world, occurs through the relationship between the eye, the ear, and the other sense organs, and our surroundings. Thinking and representation require closer examination. We must begin by being quite clear about the fact that our representations are at first merely interiorizations of our sensory life. If we look into ourselves honestly, we must conclude that through the senses we perceive impressions, while in our thinking we inwardly prolong these impressions. If we then examine our thoughts, we will find that they are shadowy images of objects mediated to us through our senses. To some extent, human thinking is entirely directed outward. Now, thinking is an activity of the etheric or formative force body. Therefore, we could say that insofar as a waking human being thinks as a sensory earthly being, he or she directs the etheric or formative force body outward. But saying that, we are really only looking at one side of the etheric or formative force body. If we consider only the content of ordinary waking consciousness, that is, thoughts about the outer world, it is as if, for some reason, we can only look at a person from behind. Imagine being able to see people only from behind. You would come up with all kinds of ideas about them that would not necessarily be very satisfying. You would then, if I may so say, be extremely curious and eager to know how people look from the front, for you would be certain that the back had a front, and that precisely the front, the other side, was the most expressive side for physical earthly beings. So it is with us. When we become conscious of our thinking about the outer world, we realize that we are, in a certain way, looking at the back, the hither side of thinking. Thinking is reversed, because in human beings the direction of the stream from the senses is always from the front to the back. No matter what appearances may be, therefore, we must be aware that what physically seems to be the front is actually the back for thinking. We must become able to look at human thinking from the other side, the side where thinking is not directed toward the impressions received from the outer senses, but where it shows its hidden inner side. Here we encounter something quite remarkable. Thinking does not appear to us from the inside as it does when we think of it as the images of the outer world that we carry in consciousness. Considered from this other side, thinking, which is really the forces that make up the etheric body, is transformed into the forces that build up our physical organism, the creative forces at work in our physical organs. We see the other side of thinking, the thinking that organized and actively shaped us out of the body of etheric or formative forces, when we consider the processes of growth. We need only consider how our organs are built up and, as it were, sculpted from their embryonic state. What works and lives in us as we grow and metabolize our food, everything that is in us as formative forces, all this is the other side of thinking. Ordinary thinking only produces shadowy thoughts in us. It is the back of thinking. The creative force of thinking, on the other hand, forms our thinking apparatus. It builds up our brain and our whole nervous system. This thinking is the creative force of the etheric, formative force body. It is the other side of thinking. One does not need highly developed powers of clairvoyance to become conscious of how this creative force of thinking operates in human beings as a force of growth, a formative force. We need only turn to our inner being to become conscious of the fact that thinking is an inner activity and not a ghostly replica of the outer world. To become aware of the activity of thinking, all we need to do is, as it were, retract our orientation toward the outer world and turn, instead, toward our own inner activity, to what we are thinking. When we understand the activity of thinking in this way, we also understand what human freedom is. Understanding human freedom is the same as understanding the activity of thinking. Furthermore, when we understand thinking in this way, we also understand the nature of morality, the morality that penetrates human beings, weaving through them and welling up within them. This is what I wanted to communicate in my title, Philosophy of Freedom. I wanted to, aside, that is now known as intuitive thinking as a spiritual path. End of aside. I wanted to communicate this understanding of thinking as active element, as pure activity, in contrast to thinking filled with external sensory images. I wanted to make this inward movement understandable. I wanted to show how human beings can grasp this activity of thinking within themselves, and how by this inner movement toward pure thinking, empty of sensations, human beings can grasp morality as something that arises out of pure thinking. I also wanted to show how at the same time they could achieve the consciousness of freedom. Therefore, we might say, let us reverse the direction of our thinking, the thinking that shows us only shadowy reflections of the sensory world around. For by turning it around in this way, it becomes the creative sculptural force of humanity itself. It becomes inner activity, the bearer of freedom, where the moral impulses in human nature may be caught hold of. In this way, we press forward spiritually from the physical body to the etheric, formative force body. Therefore, we may say, too, that the first step up the ladder to the spiritual world is the authentic experience of the feeling of freedom. Let us now look at dream consciousness. No matter how chaotic, how fearful or anxious, or how delightful our dreams may be, in every instance they weave and live in us in the form of images conjured up before the soul. And if we leave aside the content of our dreams and consider instead their dramatic quality, we will see how the soul, whether waking or sleeping, lives and weaves in these dream images. A particular power of the soul is expressed in dreams. The truth or falsity of the images themselves may be debated, but the very fact that the images can be formed in the first place should tell us that a power exists in the soul that forms these images. Dream images are placed before the soul by an inner power in the soul itself. A weaving inner psychic power lies at the origin of dreams. Consider the moment of awakening. As we awaken, we can sense how, emerging from the darkness of sleep, this inner weaving force is present. But then it dives down into the physical and etheric bodies. If it did not submerge in this way, you would go on dreaming. This power is the force of the astral body. The astral body cannot be self-aware when it is outside the physical and etheric bodies. It begins to feel itself, to sense its own power, only when, diving down into the physical and etheric bodies, it awakens and experiences their resistance. It may appear chaotic in dreams, but what appears chaotic is nevertheless the soul's own force. This force was living in dreams from the point of falling asleep to awakening. Now it dives down into the physical and etheric bodies. It plunges down into the circulation of blood, into the contraction and relaxation of the muscles. It immerses itself into the etheric body. Thereby it is strengthened. The dream-forming power is weak and powerless by itself. When this force is alone, dream images flit past. When it engages itself in the physical and etheric bodies and uses their organs, it becomes strong. What does this dream-forming power do as it gets stronger? It forms in us memory, recollections. Memory is nothing but the dream force incarnated in the physical and etheric bodies. Diving down into the physical body, the dream force is inserted into the ordering of the physical world. But now it no longer forms the chaotic stuff of dreams. It forms recollection in the physical world, the stuff of memory. We could remember nothing if we did not bring dream and dream force out of sleep into the physical world. For in the physical body, the dream force becomes the force of memory, of recollection. Sit quietly, turn away from the outer world of the senses, and allow your memories to play. As memories rise to the surface, still them and fill them with soul. Allow these memories, which stimulate fantasy, full rein. In this experience, it is the dream force, strengthened through the physical and etheric bodies, that rules within you. This is the same dream force that, when it was held outside the physical and etheric bodies by the astral body, was plunged in the world spirit. There, in the world spirit, the dream force experienced the secrets of things. Imagine that when asleep you could perceive this force that in your waking state creates the power of memory and recollection. You would perceive it spread out outside the physical and etheric bodies. You would not experience chaotic dream images, for these are formed only at the moment of the plunge into the physical and etheric realm. Rather, freed from the physical and etheric bodies, you would be immersed in the outer cosmos. Asleep, you would experience yourself in a majestic world of images. This majestic world is the cosmic counter-image of what rises and falls in your memories in solitary meditation. Your memory life is the microcosmic counter-image of this macroscopic, gigantic, majestic weaving and flowing of images that our dream force passes through when the astral body is plunged in the things and processes of the outer cosmos. Were we to speak of our soul's spiritual contents, we would usually find that this spiritual content rises and falls like a wave with the transmuted impressions from the outer world that live on in our memory and thinking. This content, which we make our own by our inner life, fixes everything in us, all the bliss, tragedy, joy, and suffering in our soul lives. And if we wish to consider everything that lives in our souls as the spiritual content of memory, we must remember that we owe it all to the fact that this dream-forming force, which is related to the cosmos, can plunge into our inner being. What lives in the image forces in the outer cosmos, creating and activating the outer world, enters into us and becomes available to us as the force of memory that spiritualizes our soul. In the power of memory, we feel ourselves to be related to all the creative and active forces of the universe. We may therefore affirm the following, quote, I look outside and see the forms of the unfolding plants in spring. I look into the woods and see how trees develop out of their seeds year after year, decade after decade. I look up at the clouds changing under the influence of more outer formative forces. I look out and see how mountains form and erode. I look upon all these formative forces right up into the stars. There is something related to all of this in my soul. I have the powers of memory in my soul. And these powers are the microscopic reflection of the forces at work in the world, in the metamorphoses of all things. Close quote. Let us now consider the capital I. In sleep, likewise, the I leaves the physical and etheric bodies behind and unites outside them with cosmic things and processes. Thus we become aware of how, as human beings, we are able to dive down into things with our own actual being, even if the experience remains unconscious. The I itself, at any rate, certainly emerges from deep sleep and enters into the physical and etheric bodies. But only spiritual scientific initiation can follow this process. As far as our memory of it is concerned, the way the dream force slips into the physical being provides ordinary observation with something to hang on to as we try to understand it. To do this, one must learn to observe with the imagination when we develop it in the way I have described in title How to Know Higher Worlds. Having learned to observe with the imagination, we can learn to observe how the I, which sojourned with cosmic things and processes during sleep, is submerged in the physical and etheric bodies. We can also learn to observe the transformation undergone by the I when it emerges from the darkness of sleep. To present-day human development on Earth, the I at first seems powerless, sunk in the darkness of sleep, in the darkness of the soul. Yet when it plunges into the physical and etheric bodies, it strengthens itself there. It becomes wrapped up in the paths opened by the physical and etheric bodies. It takes hold of the force of the blood and works through the inner power of blood. This is shown in waking day consciousness. The I, immersing itself in the physical and etheric bodies, manifests itself. The I is what weaves and works as the free element in the human being. It may show itself or not. And when it does, what is its characteristic manifestation? When the I manifests, it is the force of love that appears in humanity. We would never have the capacity to open into another being or another process, to pass, as it were, into the other, if the I did not leave us every night to immerse itself in the things and processes of the outer cosmos. It really is submerged there. When the I slips into us in waking consciousness, it communicates within us the ability to love that it attained outside. This, then, is what rises up in the depths of your inner life as the threefold power of the soul: freedom, the life of memory, and the force of love. Freedom is the etheric body's inner primordial form. Memory is the astral body's dream-forming force arising within us. Love is the guiding force that arises within us so that we can surrender ourselves dedicatedly to the outer world. When and to the extent that the human soul participates in this threefold force, it is transfused with spiritual life. When thoroughly imbued with these three forces, the sensation of freedom, the force of memory which allows us to connect past and present, and the force of love through which we can give our inner life for the outer world and unite with it, our soul is, in quotes, spiritualized. The inner possession of these three powers permeates the soul with spirit. To grasp this with the right nuance of soul is to grasp that human beings bear the spirit within their souls. Whoever does not understand the spirit's threefold inner penetration of the soul through freedom, memory, and love will not understand how the human soul can shelter the spirit. The consequences of this extend over the whole of life. Something wonderful can definitely be attained once we are able to establish an inner living connection between memory and love, the power of memory presiding in us by virtue of the astral body, the power of love given by the I. These things may be directly grasped in life. We preserve the memory of a beloved one who has died beyond death. We carry the person's image in our soul. We combine the sensory impressions that we received when the person was alive with what remains when their sensory existence is taken away from us. We continue to live with the dead in memory, with all the power and intensity of our soul, to the point that we no longer need the support of external sensations. We try to bring such a living quality to these memories that it may seem as if the dead were there with us, as if truly living, as if we had a direct apprehension of their livingness. We remain conscious that we bear these things in our memory, but we connect it with the force that came about as the result of the strengthening of the astral body, the force that we received through our I, the force of love. We carry this intense love for the dead over and beyond the grave. Previously, we were able to develop the force of love under the influence of sensory stimulation. Now, we become capable of connecting the force of love with the image that is no longer aroused by the senses. Thus, it is possible to strengthen what otherwise would only be expressed by the astral body and the eye when they made use of the physical organs. This is a way to rise inwardly to a certain level of separation from the astral body and I. You preserve the memory of the dead, which can no longer be stimulated by the physical and etheric bodies, and hold it so intensely and animatedly that you are able to unite it with intense love. One of the first steps toward liberating the I and the astral body from the physical and etheric bodies while awake rests precisely in the memory that we can preserve of the dead. If we could only understand the significance of keeping memory alive, we would be on the path that leads over the threshold between the physical and spiritual worlds. If we could only understand what it means to contemplate the image that is all that is left of the dead, in the same way as we contemplate the living person, we would experience the liberation of the astral body and the I. We would have the following experience or shock. At first, we have the living memory, as if the person who had died were still there. We know that in our waking consciousness, we have connected the image of the dead person with the love that we once used to feel only under the influence of sensory impressions from the then living person. We make all this active and alive within us. When we can develop the necessary inner strength, then the shock comes. We step over the threshold into the spiritual world. The dead person is present in full reality. This is one of the paths that human beings can take into the spiritual world. It is connected with things in the face of which one can feel only reverence. Even when we understand them, we can experience them only with reverence and a certain serious inner gravity. This is one example of crossing the threshold into the spiritual world. We must allow all the seriousness associated with such ideas to work on our souls. We must make this seriousness real. Then we will have an idea of the seriousness that must be united with any crossing into the spiritual world. If we truly wish to enter the spiritual world, if in all earnestness we wish to grasp it, life must have shown us its deep seriousness because we willed it so. The science of initiation has always attempted to infuse this seriousness into culture and civilization. This is what our externalized age needs again today. It is a remarkable sign of the times that dogmatic science means more to people today than reality. A person can become conscious of his or her freedom in every moral act. As human beings, we can actually experience freedom, just as we can experience red or white. But we deny our freedom. We deny it under the authority of contemporary science. Why? Because contemporary science sees only the mechanical, where what comes earlier is always the cause of what comes later. Therefore, this science states dogmatically that everything must have a cause. It dogmatically affirms causality. Because causality must be correct, because we swear by causality as a dogma, we deafen ourselves to the feeling of freedom. Reality is buried in darkness to protect dogma. In this case, the dogma of a powerful science exercising its authority. Science abolishes life. If life became aware of itself in us, this life would directly grasp freedom in the activity of thinking. And so, a purely external science building on causality has become the great murderer of the feeling of life of human beings. We must become conscious of this. Can we then hope that having inwardly destroyed the experience of freedom, human beings can push forward to the spirit, the spiritual form of memory? Can we hope that just as they once allowed red to be a revelation of the red rose, human beings will allow memory to reveal to them the force of dream welling up and working in the universe? Can we hope that having killed the feeling of freedom in the first stage by the dogma of so-called causality, human beings will acquire the necessary conviction to rise to the second stage? Human beings fail to see the spirituality of their own souls. They fail to reach to a level deep enough to see clearly that besides the ability to live among things in our sleep, we can attain the ability in our spiritual eye to love through our spirit. The deepest foundation of love is an eye penetrated with spirit that submerges in the physical and etheric organism. To know the spiritual nature of love means, in a certain sense, to know the spirit. Whoever knows love knows the spirit. But this requires that a person penetrate to the innermost spiritual experience of love in the knowledge and experience of it. Here is where our civilization has taken a wrong turn. Memory means moving and living in the inner soul. In our inner souls, however, distinctions are not so easily made. Only mystics like Swedenborg, Meister Eckhart, and Johannes Tauler could go deep into their inner souls, their memories, and experience the movement and life of the eternal spirit there. They speak of the little spark that lights up in human beings when they become aware within, in memory, that the same thing that lives in the microcosm lives and works outside in the creative, formative forces whose dreaming lies at the foundation of all world existence. The deep inner soul memory, however, is of course difficult to attain. Things are not so clear there. Things become very clear when we move to the third stage, when we see how, at the third level, our civilization has misunderstood the original spiritual being and weaving of love. All things spiritual naturally have an outer sensory form, for the spirit submerges in physis, the physical. The spirit incarnates in the physical. Read it again. The spirit incarnates in the physical. If the spirit forgets itself, if the spirit is only conscious of the physical, it will seem as if the physical activates what is actually activated by the spirit. This is the great delusion of our time. Our time doesn't know love. Our age fantasizes about love, lies about love. In reality, when it tries to think of love, it only knows erotic love. I am not saying that the individual person doesn't experience love. Human beings are less likely to deny the spirit in their unconscious feelings, in their unconscious will, than in their thinking. But whenever the present civilization thinks of love, it just says the word. It actually means eroticism. It is fair to say that you should read through all current literature from end to end. And whenever the word love appears, replace it with the word eroticism or sexual love. For sexual love is all that materialistic thinking knows of love. Denial of the spirit turns the force of love into an erotic force. In many areas, not only has the genius of love been supplanted by its lowly servant eroticism, but also its counter-image, the demon of love, has stepped in. The demon of love appears when something that was at work in human beings, as divinely willed, is taken over by human thinking and torn from spirituality by intellectuality. This is how it goes. Recognize the genius of love, and you will have love infused with spirit. Acknowledge love's lowly servant, and you will have eroticism. But we have fallen prey to the demon of love. The demon of love appears whenever the interpretation of love, the interpretation of sexuality as it is practiced by the current civilization, replaces love's true form. Nowadays, in fact, when we wish to speak of love, we no longer even speak of eroticism, but instead only of sexuality. Such talk about sexuality in our civilization includes much that passes for sexual education. The demon of love lives in all this intellectualized talk about sexuality. The genius of an age always appears in the form of its demon, for the demon steps in wherever the genius is denied. This is equally true of this realm, where the spiritual, in its most intimate form, love, should appear. Our age often prays, not to spirit of love, but to the demon of love, and confuses the true spirituality of love with the demonology of love in sexuality. Naturally, in this area, in particular, the most complete misunderstandings occur. For what lives at the core of sexuality is, of course, saturated by spiritual love. But humanity can fall from this spiritualization of love, and it is most likely to fall in the age of intellectualism. When the intellect takes the form I described yesterday, then what is spiritual in love is forgotten, and only its external form is considered. It is in the power of human beings to deny their own being. They deny it when they sink down from the genius of love to the demon of sexuality, by which I mean, above all, the way our present time feels these things, the way they are mostly present. In view of this, anthroposophy can act as our guide, not just in knowledge and knowing, but also in our innermost soul being and soul life. For we can become intimate with anthroposophy, and we will become intimate with her if we understand how to take in her reality. Someone suggested today that we should describe an image of anthroposophy, a picture. But is anthroposophy not present as a reality? Do we really need another image? What we need is to become intimate with anthroposophy by means of our own inner sincerity. Then anthroposophy will penetrate the innermost texture of our soul life and soul being. We should not try to form an image in an outer way, but inwardly we should try to form an intimate relationship with the living form of the being who, as anthroposophy, will walk in our ranks if we are united as men and women who understand these things. We must live concretely with anthroposophy as a real being that moves among us. If we are truly human and on intimate terms with the being of anthroposophy, then the impulse will surely arise in us to really experience what humanity needs so much in our time. We do not need a mere image for the eye of the soul. Our hearts need a love for the being of anthroposophy. This is what we need. This can be the best impulse for our age. Today, I've tried to add a spiritual perspective to the physical and psychological perspectives that anthroposophy gives us. The spiritual perspective does not consist in following the spirit externally. Rather, it is the experience of anthroposophy in the deepest recesses of the human soul and heart. This intimate experience of anthroposophy in the human soul and heart is the meditation that will lead us to a true encounter with anthroposophy. The end of Lecture 3, and that is the end of this small set of lectures, What is Anthroposophy? By Rudolf Steiner.